So today we'll be discussing distributions, which are a generalization of the notion of a function. One example of a distribution you probably are aware of that's not a function is the Dirac delta, which we'll discuss in more detail and discuss its properties. And then for the next three lectures, we'll be discussing special functions. So for the first two of those lectures, I'll be discussing how special functions arise as solutions to differential equations, their most important properties that you should be aware of. And I'll be focusing, so this is a very broad topic, I'll be focusing on the special functions that will be most relevant to you as physicists. And during the final lecture, I'll give a brief introduction to the subject of asymptotics, and in particular focus on how to understand the properties of some of the special functions we'll discuss tomorrow and on Friday at large or small values of the argument. So that's a broad outline of where I'll be going for the next few days. So let me give you slightly more detailed discussion of what I'll be talking about today. So the subject of today's lecture is distributions. And so as I mentioned, what a distribution is a generalization of the notion of function. So most of the functions you know are distributions. But this is a broader class and includes many objects that are not functions. So why do we want to study these objects? So simplest example I've referred to several times is the Dirac delta. So for instance, if we're studying a point charge, which has a charge density that's 0 for x not equal to 0 and infinite at x equals 0, such that the total charge is finite, this is not a well-behaved function. So in your previous courses, you've probably glossed over some of the details and where you can go wrong if you try to think of a distribution like this, which is proportional to the Dirac delta as a function. So most of the time it's okay, but there's a few places where you can go wrong if you try to think of this as a function. I'll point some of those pitfalls out during today's lecture. There are other cases where our usual notion of a function doesn't suffice. So for instance, in our quantum field theory courses, we'll run across expressions like this all the time. Not exactly this, but we'll have run across integrals that seemingly diverge. We're integrating over momentum. Can run across an expression like this that doesn't seem to have a well-defined value. And using the theory of distributions is one way that we can make sense of integrals like this. And so in today's lecture, besides the Dirac delta, the most important example of a distribution that's not a function that we'll be discussing is known as the principal value and the closely related I epsilon distributions, which I'll discuss briefly today, and you'll look in more detail at in tutorial tomorrow. So those are important for quantum field theory. Finally, another reason we want to look at distributions is for existence. We can come up with well-defined physical problems that just don't have solutions that are ordinary functions. For instance, if we want to take a limit of sequence of functions, the limit is not always a function. Sometimes it's a distribution. And in the variational problems that you'll learn about in Dennis's course later, don't always have solutions that are their functions, that are often distributions. OK. So let's come back to this most important example. The Dirac delta. OK, so the way you've probably seen it defined is as a limit of sequence of functions. So let's say this is equal to f of x, which is the limit as sigma goes to 0 of some sequence of functions that's indexed by sigma. Just in quotation marks. Where f sigma could, for instance, be a function that goes 1 over sigma for x less than sigma over 2, and is 0 otherwise. And so each of the elements of this sequence has property that we want the Dirac delta to satisfy, which is that it's integral over the reals is 1 for all values of sigma. And this limiting function, in quotation marks, is 0. For x not equal to 0. So this is sort of intuitively how we think of the Dirac delta. So this is not a precise definition. And to see why we need to be a little more careful, I need to introduce a few definitions. What we mean by a function. Okay. So, first definition we'll need is a function space. So, this is a vector space whose elements are functions. So it satisfies all the properties that you learned about in your algebra course earlier. In particular, satisfies positivity in that any function with a norm, it satisfies positivity. So the norm of any function in this space is non-negative. And there's a unique element with zero norm. It also satisfies the triangle inequality. the norm of the sum of two functions is less than the sum of the norms. And finally, it satisfies linear homogeneity. Means we can multiply a function by a real number, and the norm is equal to the absolute value of that real number times the norm of f.
Are we thinking that norm has been used by some inner product in the function space?
I'm just about to get there, yes.
Oh, okay.
But
it's not something that it's necessary.
It's not something that's necessary for a function space. You can have a function space where the norm does not come from an inner product. But in physics, the most important examples are those that do come from inner products. So for instance, you could take this norm to be, say, the supremum of the function, and that satisfies all these properties, but it doesn't come from an inner product. Okay. So the most important function spaces are actually inner product spaces, as just asked, which means that the norm comes from an inner product. And the most common norm that we'll deal with is what's known as the L2 norm, where the norm is just given by the integral of f star g. And for the most part, I'll be specializing to real functions. But so you may see me occasionally leave off the star, but should be self-explanatory where to put it back in when you're dealing with complex functions. And so the norm in this case is just the square root of the inner product of the function itself. And so the space we'll be dealing most frequently with is L2 AB. So this is the space of square integral functions. On the interval AB, where A and B could be either finite real numbers or plus or minus infinity. Okay, so already, if we make this definition, if we want all square integrable functions to be in our function space, we see a problem with the first of our assumptions about vector space. So in particular, one of the requirements for a function space to be a vector space is that it has a unique additive identity, which is not the case if we allow all square integrable functions without any identifications. So in particular, if we look at two functions, one of which is just identically zero, this has a zero norm. But we can construct other functions that also have zero norms. So for instance, we can say at zero, except at one, and pi at one. And so since we've only modified it at a point, this function still has zero norm. So if we want this to satisfy our definitions, we have to make an identification. And so the elements of L2 are not functions, but equivalence classes of functions. So here, can slightly generalize our definition and allow these to be equivalence classes. And so in particular, this means that elements of this space don't have a well-defined value at any point. So these are fairly general functions. But this space is not general enough to include the delta function. As we can see, by computing the norm of our sequence that we tried to use to define the delta function. So if we do that, find the norm of f sigma squared is equal to the integral of f sigma of x squared, which is just the integral 1 over sigma squared, or 1 over sigma. And so if we take the limit that sigma goes to 0, and get our limit limiting object f, this diverges. So this is not square integral. We need to have the norm needs to be finite for it to be part of our space. So it's not general enough to include the Dirac delta. Okay. So what can go wrong if we try to define this Dirac delta in this way? So let's try to understand the limiting object a bit more. So let's so this is more general than the case I've written up there. So let's choose a sequence G sigma, which converges to G. Try to identify with the delta function, for which the limit sigma goes to 0 of G sigma of x equals 0 for x not equal to 0, and the integral of g sigma of x dx equals 1 for all sigma. Okay, so for most of these sequences, we can fit them inside of boxes like this. So we can draw a box here of width epsilon and height 1. And draw another box that has height 1 and half the width. One over 2, and so on. So for this choice of a sequence and most others, we can for each sigma, we can find an epsilon so that G sigma lies in the boxes. For, we can find it. For each sigma star, we can find so that for sigma less than sigma star. Okay. So if all the G sigmas lie in the box, then G should also lie in these boxes. So that means, yes. So I've I've made a choice here. So there's different constructions you could make that will lead to the same problem that I'm about to point out. But I've chosen to have the height of each of the boxes be 1 here, not the area. So we wouldn't want to choose the area because if the area of each of the boxes was 1, then these would have infinite area. So then if we construct an infinite sequence of boxes like this, then the total area in the boxes would be infinite, which would would make the argument I'm about to make fail.
What's the next epsilon up say? It says epsilon, and then what's the one above it?
This is epsilon over 2, sorry. So each time we're making the boxes half as wide and with the same height. Okay. So
you're making it half as wide every time and increasing the height by 1?
So the height of each of these rectangles is 1.
Okay.
This here is 0, this is 1, this is 2. So this box runs from y equals 1 to y equals 2.
Okay, all right.
Is that clear?
Switch that.
All right. So the reason we draw boxes like this is that we expect that the limit is very concentrated just around x equals 0. That has a limiting height, divergent height. So G lies inside the boxes, the limit. And that means that the integral of G of x has to be less than the area of the boxes, which is, as we can see, the first box has area epsilon, the next one has area epsilon over 2, and the third one has epsilon over 4, and so on. So the total area is just 2 epsilon. But this is true for any epsilon. I'm sorry, this should be. For each epsilon. For each epsilon, we can find sigma, so that this lies inside the box. So in particular, this means that the integral of g of x dx is 0, which is not what we want it to be. We wanted it to be 1, because that 1 is equal to the limit of sigma goes to 0 of the integral of g sigma of x dx. So we can't switch the order of the integral and limit. And this is a problem. So this sequence exhibits what's known as pointwise convergence. But it doesn't converge with respect to the L2 norm, as we saw. So this limit is not really a function. So we're going to need to be more careful when we define it so that we can know which operations are allowed. Jason?
When you say that it's not a function, do you actually mean it's not a function or just that it's not an element of L2?
I mean it's not a function. I've shown that it's not an element of L2, but it's not a function. It doesn't. Its behavior at x equals 0 is too wild for it to be a function. So we just tried to define a function that's zero everywhere and infinite at zero. It wouldn't obey our usual ideas about how integration works for functions. So we're going to need to generalize that slightly. Does that answer your question?
I just think that the definition of a function is that it's well-defined, that you don't have two elements that map to the same, that it's not multi-valued, for example. So what's, what's the stronger definition of a function?
So I don't want to
get
into that, but we can discuss that later. But basically, we want the rules of integration and limits to work in a well-defined way. Okay, so how can we come up with a rigorous definition of delta? So it behaves nicely as long as we keep it under an integral sign. This sort of problem occurs when we try to take it out of an integral sign. So let's generalize that notion and think about how we can, what an integral is. So an integral basically is a map from a function to the real numbers. And so let's expand on that. To do that, we're going to need to introduce what are known as test functions. And so we could choose different test function spaces. I'm going to stick with one. So a DBR space of test functions. And I'm going to choose to be the set of continuous, infinitely differentiable functions with compact support. So compact support means that it's identically zero outside of a finite interval. So most of the following discussion we'll choose with a less restrictive set of test function space. For instance, we're really only going to use that it has two derivatives, or maybe three for most of our discussion. And we could relax this assumption and allow functions that go to zero sufficiently fast at plus or minus infinity. The important point is that we can, with this choice, it makes it easier to neglect. Our boundary conditions will be easier, as we'll see shortly. Yes.
Can you say what the definition of compact support is again?
So this means that it's identically zero outside of a finite interval. This is the definition for real functions.
Does it fall off to zero smoothly, or can it like? Can you have a discontinuity at the end and then just?
So I'm assuming that they're continuous and infinitely differentiable. That's not essential. It's not essential for the construction, but that's assumption there.
With respect to the limit over there, mm-hmm. If I want a sequence of functions of L2 functions that go to delta, I will never accomplish it, right?
That's correct.
Delta won't be on L2. But the thing is, isn't that a problem of how does the integral of the sequence converges? I mean, this converges pointwise, but if I choose some sequence of functions that converge uniformly.
There is no sequence of functions in L2 that converges uniformly to delta.
All right.
Delta.
So, okay.
Any other questions? Okay. So, our test function space is a vector space. So with the L2 norm, this test function space satisfies all of the definitions I made previously. And we can define a dual vector space, which I call D star. And it's the vector space of linear functionals from D to R. So that means that U is an element of this dual vector space if U acting on a test function phi is a real number for every test function. Okay. And we're almost there. So the space of distributions, which I call D prime, is the largest continuous dual space. And continuous here means if a sequence of test functions converges uniformly to a limit phi, then U of the sequence converges to U of phi as n goes to infinity in R. Okay. So given this technology, we can come up with a rigorous definition of delta. So take the defining property of delta to be that its integral against any test function from minus infinity to infinity is equal to the value of the test function at zero. So this is the defining property of delta. Yes?
Two questions. So did you say D comes equipped with the L2 norm?
Right. Yes. Yes, we're considering here the L2 norm.
Okay, so D is a vector space with the L2. Okay, and when you say largest continuous, do you mean that any other continuous dual space will be contained in D prime?
That's right.
What do you mean by largest?
The natural election of D star on D is the inner product, right? That's where you define the action, the deltas being. I mean, for any element of the dual vector space, how does it act on an element of the vector space through the inner product?
So it's a good question. So you do know many examples of distributions. In particular, any locally integrable function is a distribution, and you can define the action of locally integrable functions on test functions through that inner product.
Okay.
But there are more general elements. For instance, delta, which is not.
Here it's off. Delta is a distribution. It's an element of the dual vector space, right?
That's right.
So in this case, it is acting in a test function through the L2 inner product, right?
I was just about to say that this notation is somewhat misleading. We'll see another example. It's the principal value distribution. It's almost defined sort of by an inner inner product, but not every distribution we can think of as just something that we can integrate against a test function to get. Yes.
So typically for finite dimensional vector spaces, we can identify D with D star.
That's right.
Product. But is it because this is an infinite dimensional space? Is that why you can't identify the delta function with an element of D?
Exactly.
Okay,
yes.
So it's the infinite dimension.
Infinite dimension is the key property.
Yes. So I'm slightly D star basically is a map from D to the reals.
That's right.
Is that the most general way to define it?
That's the most general way to define it, correct.
And in this case, we choose for that to be the L2, like, we make that the integral with the
integral
delta function.
Right.
Could you possibly give another example of how this could work without the delta?
For instance, another distribution is... a locally integrable function, like, say, x squared. We can define this. So x squared is a distribution. And if we integrate it against a test function, it satisfies all these properties. But we can also come up with other examples, like the principal value distribution, which is defined as, if we act with this on a test function, this is given by the limit as epsilon goes to 0 of integral minus infinity to minus epsilon plus epsilon to infinity of phi of x over x dx. So it's close to an L2 norm, but not exactly.
I'll do
inner.
Is that the top
so, this one? So we say this is the action of x squared on the test function.
So the distribution is integral x squared dx, is it? Or is
the distribution is the object that if we act on a test function phi, we get this number.
What did you say the norm on D prime was?
It's not well defined in general. Okay.
Sorry, if you make that choice, is the delta function then one element of the dual space or is it the whole dual?
It's an element.
It's one element.
One element. Okay. So this is a sidebar. I wanted to say something about notation. This integral notation is sort of the most common. It's generally useful, but you should be aware that it can be slightly imprecise at times. So I'm going to stick with this notion, this notation that suggests that the distributions are functionals. You'll also commonly see, and in some of the references that I posted on the wiki, the notation u phi. I don't like this notation because it suggests it's too close to an inner product. This is really a pairing, not an inner product. So I'll stick with this functional notation, mostly going back to this when we're sure that it's not going to lead us astray. Okay. And the reason that this is imprecise, this notation here is imprecise, is that delta of x is undefined because distributions are not defined at a point because the additive identity is a class of functions in the same way as L2.
Whenever I have a local integral function that gives rise to a distribution, that notation you have there can be interpreted as a real integral, right? I can manipulate it as if I'm integrating the product of two functions, right?
This?
Yep.
So if it depends on the distribution. So some distributions are functions, and
right.
We can
I can manipulate
them just in a standard way. So
okay, but if it's not, for example, if it's for the delta, which is not a function, mm-hmm. How should I interpret that notation, that integral?
How to interpret? So the precise notation then. This is here delta. So delta of
that's fine.
Yeah, this is fine. We can say that this is delta of phi. So we take this as the defining relation. Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You said the reason that notation is not precise because delta of x is not defined. As a function.
It's not defined, and okay. Some of the operations that you can normally do on functions you can't do. So I'll in a minute or later in the lecture, I'll talk about multiplication of distribution of functions, derivatives, and composition. And these work similarly in many cases, but there are important differences.
So let's say I take that integral. I know that phi has compact support and it's infinitely differentiable, mm-hmm. So I can. I would like to integrate by parts there. I can cannot do it because delta, I cannot have the derivative of delta.
I'll get there in a minute.
All right.
In a minute. Just about to get there. Mm-hmm. So does this. Is this a distribution? Can anyone tell me? It is or is not, and why? Good. Okay. So this is not a distribution. Okay, so let me try to answer some of those questions that were coming up about operations on distributions. And the first operation we might like to perform on distributions is taking a derivative. Okay. So usual way we define derivatives is as a limit. This doesn't work. We can't define the value of a distribution at a point in general. So can't do that. U of x is undefined. So what else can we do? So I mentioned that some distributions are ordinary functions. And what we can do is we can take inspiration from those functions and then demand that the distributions that aren't functions obey the same properties. So if u is a function, we can evaluate u prime acting on phi by evaluating the integral u prime of x, phi of x, using integration by parts. So this step is only okay if u is a function. Now we can simplify this expression here using the properties of test functions. So
what have you written? It's okay if u is a
function.
Function.
Yeah, we don't need any of this technology if u is a function. But those are the class of distributions that we understand. And so we can take inspiration from those to try to come up with definitions that make sense for all distributions. So this first term is zero. Good. And that's because, very good. So phi is zero in outside of a finite region. So it's identically zero in a region for all x greater than some value and all x less than some value. So we can neglect this. And so this here, if we write in our functional notation, is just minus phi prime, minus u of phi prime. And so we'll take this as a definition. So we'll define this to be and note that phi prime always exists because we assume that our test functions are differentiable.
That's the way of defining it, but for example, the first one you wrote, I cannot generalize it in the case, since D is a vector space, right? I have a base of test functions, right?
Mm-hmm.
So can I just define the derivative of u at phi as, for example, the limit of, I mean, instead of x, just some functions plus epsilon, which would be the basis of D? I mean, it's kind of a functional derivative. So my question is if this derivative coincides with the functional derivative of the distribution. I guess.
So if there's any way to salvage this definition, there may be, but it would involve.
A distribution is a functional.
Functional, yes.
Right. If I take the functional derivative of the distribution, does it is the same as this definition of the derivative? Both coincide, or
this coincides in all cases where u is an ordinary function. So this is more general than other definitions, or at least as general. Yeah.
And why does the first part evaluate to zero?
So this is zero because of our choice of test function space. So we chose, because of our choice of test function space,
okay,
we chose test functions that have compact support, meaning that they vanish outside of a finite interval.
Okay.
So, so 5x is identically 0 for all x greater than some x naught. So in, at infinity, it's 0. And it doesn't even matter what this is doing.
Can you give an example of such a test function? I'm having trouble imagining a function that's infinitely differentiable, but is that
sure.
Zero?
So e to the minus 1 over 1 minus x squared for x less than 1 and 0 otherwise. And similarly, we can define nth derivatives in an analogous way. So if you want to calculate the nth derivative, you can just define that to be minus 1 to the n. Times u of 5n. So let's see how this works. So this is called the weak or distributional derivative. It's the terminology. Example. Let's calculate the weak derivative of the Heaviside function, which is defined to be 1 for x greater than or equal to 0 and 0 otherwise. So first of all, defines a derivative, defines a distribution, because theta of a test function is just integral of theta times the test function, which is just the integral from 0 to infinity 5x, which has to be finite because phi is finite everywhere, and it's 0 outside of a finite region. So that tells us that this is a map from the test functionals to the real numbers. And it's clearly linear and continuous. OK, so if we want to calculate the derivative using our definitions here, so the derivative of the Heaviside function is equal to minus the Heaviside function acting on the derivative of phi, which is the integral minus the integral from 0 to infinity of phi prime of x dx. So this is just an ordinary integral. We can integrate by parts or just directly integrate. And we get phi of infinity minus phi of 0. This is just 0. And so we get phi of 0. And this is the same as delta of phi, which means that the derivative of the Heaviside function is the delta function, just as we'd expect. Because if we act with either of these distributions on any test function, we get the same thing. Okay, let's look at a slightly more involved example. Yes.
In this case, pi is, or I'm sorry, theta is, it's a distribution, but it's also a function in the usual sense.
That's correct.
Okay.
Okay, so let's look at the natural log, the absolute value of x as a distribution. So let's act with this on a test function. So try to define this as the integral the natural log of the absolute value of x times phi of x. Is this real? Is this a finite real number? So what happens near x equals 0? This diverges. This is not necessarily zero. So there exist test functions for which this integral doesn't make sense.
Another question. The fact that phi of x is c infinity, it implies that when it goes to infinity, it goes faster than any other function?
We're considering c infinity functions with finite support. So they, yes, they're identically zero in a region. Almost everything I've said generalizes if we consider test functions that are C infinity, they go to zero faster than any polynomial as x goes to plus or minus infinity. So we can fix this definition and make it finite by cutting out a region near zero. So let's instead define this distribution as the limit epsilon goes to 0 And I claim that now this does define a distribution. So it's linear and continuous, clearly, but it's also now finite for all test functions. And to see that, we can write this as the limit as epsilon goes to 0 of integral from epsilon to infinity of 5x minus 5 minus x times the natural log epsilon value of x. And we don't need the epsilon value of that anymore. We can write this as So near zero, this is approximately I'll write this as limit epsilon goes to zero of phi of x minus phi of minus x. It's equal to the limit epsilon goes to zero of 2 phi prime of 0 times epsilon. And that's just because this is differentiable, so we can write phi prime of 0 as approximately 5x minus 5 minus x over epsilon, over x, for x small. So this, in fact, as x goes to 0, the integrand goes as x log x, which is finite. So this is a distribution.
I'm not sure about the last two lines. You went from that, you altered your definition, and then how'd you go? Phi of x minus phi of minus x.
Let me write this as this.
It's near zero, you have to plug.
Yeah, I'll write this as. This is approximately equal to phi prime of x of 0, this over x is approximately the derivative for x small.
Couldn't you have made that same argument in the first line? What's the difference between the first line and there about the finiteness of the integrand?
Because here we don't actually have the point 0. So what we've done here is, this can diverge. What we've done is we've cut out the divergent region in a particular way so that the infinite, there's...
If you had made the epsilon different, like if you had an epsilon, like if you're approaching from the left with epsilon and from the right with like epsilon prime, then that would be equal to the first line, right?
What
cuts it out is the fact that
if we put a 2 here, if we put a 2 here,
that
would change the answer.
Yeah, so I'm saying what makes it converge is the fact that you're approaching that limit in the same way,
right?
Which is what makes it different from the first line. That because in the first line, you could also take the limit to 0, but to take the limit correctly, you'd have to approach it differently, right? You'd have to have like an epsilon and an epsilon prime.
Right. We could. So this is a choice of a regularization of a divergent integral, and so there's always a choice there. In some sense, this is the most natural way to regulate this integral because we're doing something symmetric. But we could choose other ways to make this give a finite answer, and those different regularizations could give us different answers. Yes, thank you. Okay, so we can now calculate the derivative of this distribution. Using our rules. And this just gives us which we can integrate by parts. To get plus boundary terms. So the boundary terms at infinity vanish the same way as before. We still are left with these terms at the interior boundaries. But see here that we have exactly the same thing, same expression that we had before, that we needed to go to zero. In order to make the distribution finite or zero at zero. So these terms cancel in the same way as before. And we're left with exactly how I defined the principal value distribution earlier. Exactly the same expression that I used to define the principal value. And so this is so alluded to earlier, one way that we can regulate divergent integrals. It's closely related to the I epsilon prescription, Feynman. So you'll come back to this in your quantum field theory courses, and we'll explore more about this in tutorial tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. When you have that first expression there, that the integral of the delta times the delta function is phi 0, if I take phi to be 1, right, the function 1, which doesn't have a complex support,
mm-hmm.
What does it mean that the integral of delta direct is 1?
Oh, sorry. 1 is not a test function.
Yeah, but so what does it mean then that the integral of the delta function has to be 1? If I'm defining the action of a mm-hmm. distribution on test functions, so if 1 is not a test function.
What we can do is we can multiply delta by 1 in a way that I'm just about to tell you.
Okay.
So, and then we can act with the product of the distribution and the function on
a
test function. That's exactly what I was about to say. So the next operation we might be interested in performing on distributions is multiplication by a function. And so again, we can take inspiration from the distributions that are functions. So if we have a function psi and we're multiplying it by a distribution u that is a function, we can act with that on a test function. And if u is a function also, we can write that as the integral of psi of x, u of x, times phi of x, which is just u of x times psi of x, phi of x. So this is exactly what you might expect. So we can then write this as u acting on psi times phi. And we'll take that as a definition. So, how does this work? So, So we can define delta A to be a shifted delta function.
So the delta A of phi is equal to phi of A.
And let's calculate psi times delta A. Psi is some ordinary function. So using our definition, this is just delta A of psi phi, which is equal to psi phi of A, which is equal to psi of A times phi of A, which is equal to psi of A times delta A of phi. So that means that psi times delta A is equal to phi of A delta. In particular, this implies that x times delta is identically zero, is a zero distribution. And x times delta prime is equal to minus delta, it's the derivative of, act of this on a test function, this, which we can use the chain rule to write as phi plus x phi prime. Which this actually should have been out front. X delta. And this is zero. So if we multiply the derivative of the delta function by x, we just get minus sign.
Does it matter that x is not in L2?
No. So our definition of multiplication did not assume that. So we're not assuming here that psi is a test function.
It only needs to be smooth, right?
It only needs to be locally integrable, smooth. But it doesn't need to be globally integrable. So I guess.
We still need that psi times phi has to be a test function, right? So psi has to be at least smooth or something.
That's right. Psi times phi has to be a test function, but psi can be more general than that. More general than a test function. So I guess tomorrow I'll finish up distributions by telling you about how to compose them with functions, and then we'll move on to orthogonal functions and special functions. Are there any more questions?
So, Emily. I can't remember. What was the correct name of the PV, whatever its distribution?
Principal value.
Principal value.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll see you tomorrow.